a podcast about Canadian cinema and our relationship with film. My name is Andrew Hunter Scully, and today we are discussing Ravenous, released in 2017, directed by Robin Aubert, screenplay by Robin Aubert. And to join me, we have Colin Everett. How are you doing, Colin?
Doing good.
All right, we'll see how this one goes. We had an interesting exchange yesterday before I even had a chance to see the movie. I got to stop saying this, a little bit of a different episode this time. We have a few episodes planned in the future. However, they involve a lot of research. Like, I have to read books for them, and finding the time to do that has been difficult. And as well, scheduling always happens, but I do have like the next three or four planned out, but there was this little window here. You and I were hanging out, nothing to do with the show. We were just hanging out, and I brought up that I have this window. I mean, obviously you've been on the show before. You're a great guest. You're kind of a fun, spontaneous guest to have on.
I like being the pitch hitter.
Yeah, you know, you come in, we pick a film that usually doesn't require a ton of research. And I also realized that this episode would be releasing either the day of or the day before Halloween. So I thought, hey, why don't we just pick a random Canadian horror movie? Wouldn't take a lot of research, gives me a little bit more time to work on the other episodes. And you agreed.
Yeah.
There was one problem. We had no idea what movie we were going to do. Usually at least one of us has like a suggestion. So after a couple of beers at the local watering hole, I just Googled best Canadian horror films. And one that came up quite a fair bit on these lists that kind of piqued my attention was Ravenous, a 2017 Quebec zombie film.
Yeah, this one was a bit of a mixed bag for me, but there's some good parts of it.
Yeah, I started to read up on it. There were a couple of things that kind of piqued my interest a little bit. I just kind of thought, okay, yeah, a good solid zombie film. You know, we've done weirdly quite a few zombie films on the show, actually. We've done Fido. We did Pontypool, which is kind of a zombie film. And then we did Blood Quantum, Jeff Barnaby's Blood Quantum. So I was like, okay, why not another zombie film? We don't have to get too much into our backgrounds with zombie films, where we've seen them, what ones we've seen and stuff like that. So we agreed on this one. And also, I looked a little bit into the director, Mr. Robin Aubert. I will get this out of the way. I had never heard of him before or any of his films. So I decided to take a peek into his career. And some of his other films looked really interesting as well. We will get to this. I did watch one of his other films. So as well, it's always fun on the show to discover. I don't want to say new talent, but, you know, air quotes, new talent, like to you.
Yeah.
Is really kind of fun. And this succeeded in setting out to do that. Robin Aubert is definitely on my radar. And I mean, despite our feelings about this film, I'll get out of the way. I actually really dug it.
It left me a little cold. Maybe it was the headspace I was watching in, but I found it like the pace put me off a little bit. It also felt like it was borrowing from other zombie movies that I have seen do some of its ideas better.
Yes, we will talk about that, especially what I could dig up from the background. As typical, especially with Quebec cinema, the amount of information out there in English is pretty slight. I could only find a couple of very brief articles, mainly because this film was released in the States on Netflix.
Right.
Not in Canada, but on Netflix. So a couple of places like The Rapid, IndieWire did very brief interviews with him. But no, as I was saying, I'm going to be looking out for some of his films in the future. I'm intrigued enough. I might dig up some of his other films. But yeah, like I said, I dug it. So this is kind of a first for the show because, I mean, we don't always have to be high-fiving each other, being rah-rah about a film. But because neither of us had seen it before, we both went in cold, which might be the first time that has ever happened with the show. Either myself or the guest who brings the film or TV show has experience with it.
Yeah.
So this is the first time we've gone totally cold. I was out for a couple of beers yesterday in the afternoon. I had a book I had to finish and get to the library. Like I said, I've been having to do a lot of reading recently. So you message me while I'm reading and understandably, you're like, what time do you want to meet up tomorrow?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, you know, like I don't have a lot of prep to do or anything like that mid-afternoon. So we settled on 3 o'clock and you immediately started to go into how this film might have not been to your taste.
Yeah, I found the... I think the really thing that put me off a lot of it is I exist... Like, my appreciation of a kind of road trip movie, so to speak, is on a really tenuous line. If it feels like I don't have a clear, like, so in this movie, a group of disparate survivors are trying to make their way to this bunker where they're looking for safety from the zombie outbreak. And the thing that vexed me the whole time was I didn't have a clear sense of how long the journey was taking, what distance the journey was covering, where even the destination was, and what meaningfully the stakes were of getting there, besides we all know what a bunker is, therefore protection.
That's really interesting, because none of that crossed my mind.
Yeah.
We'll get into the visuals of this film. I just got on the film's wavelength.
Mm-hmm.
It was nice after a long day and getting home and just kind of flopping on the couch, and I just got on its vibes. But with what we were discussing before, this is kind of interesting and kind of part of the experiment of both going in blind. Mm-hmm. So let's get into this then. Shall we do a little bit of a background? There's not a lot.
Sure, yeah.
Okay, so starts with director Robin Aubert. Seems like a very interesting dude. He got his start in a sketch comedy group called Les Chicken Swell, is the name of this group. Go online. They do have videos online. Mm-hmm. I didn't watch any of them. I can parse out French,
right,
but I don't speak French. Also wasn't really in the mood for any sketch comedy when I was doing research. But it seemed to be around for a while. I think they had some sort of a TV show that lasted 47, 48 episodes on Quebec TV. Of course, all reviews, even the Wikipedia page, is only in French. Mm-hmm. So even if I wanted to learn more about it, I would have to Google Translate line by line. I did that for one film before for a couple of articles because there were things that I really wanted to know. I'm going to avoid doing that if need be.
Explaining why a joke is funny is already bad, but then if you also have to have Google Translate do it for you, you're in bad territory.
Fair enough. And then immediately after that, he moved into stage acting and TV and film acting. His first major role was a film called The Countess of Baton Rouge. This is kind of on my radar. It's kind of a lot of Quebec film is really into its magic realism in their films. This seems like one of those that actually films in and around Louisiana. Kind of my jam, so I might check it out at some point. Regardless, he was nominated for the Genie for Best Actor for that role. So you have a comedian transitioning into more serious fare in this instance. He's been in a lot of other films acting-wise, none of which I really know at all. The only one to really point out is that he has a role in Maelstrom, which is the 2000 Denis Villeneuve film.
Right.
I believe it was his second feature, if I remember right reading up. That's another interesting, wacky movie. That's one. Have a beer I'd really like to do on the show at some point.
Yeah.
He began making shorts in 1989. And then his first feature film was Saint Martyrs of the Damned in 2005. This is the other film of his I checked out. I forwarded you a quote from a review that basically said it was like William Castle crossed with David Lynch.
Okay.
And I was like, okay, I gotta see this film. And it's interesting. It's very much a first feature film with a lot of ideas kind of smashed up against each other. I do agree with the Lynch comparison. William Castle, I mean, there are some jump scares, weird kind of goofy special effects. But I was also really reminded of Oliver Stone's U-Turn.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever see U-Turn?
No.
Yeah, normal guy drives into the small out of the way town, and there's a bunch of weird eccentric locals and things start turning dark and nasty.
Right.
That sort of a thing. There's some secret in the town, things like that. But I ended up really liking it. Like I said, when I was talking about in the intro, I'm just kind of glad that this filmmaker's on my radar.
Yeah.
You know, I just think it's kind of cool. Whether or not the vibe, I think he's very much a vibe director. Whether or not the vibe works for you or not, it's just kind of cool to know that there's a different person out there making weird, unique cinema.
Yeah.
That's very much their own. So that made a lot of waves. And then he has a few other films, but his most recent one is this one, Ravenous. It should be pointed out that it won the Toronto International Film Festival Award for Best Canadian Film of that year. And it was nominated at the Canadian Screen Awards, formerly the Genies that we mentioned, for Best Film, Best Director, Best Supporting Actress, Original Score, and Makeup, for which it won.
Yeah, the makeup one I 100% agree on. There is some fantastic prosthetic work on some of the wounds and stuff, really, and just fantastic stuff.
I think I won't say you will like the film after I explain the background of it, but I think you will appreciate it.
I think I'm starting to
click a little bit more.
After hearing some of the background on some of the other stuff he's done, I think I'm understanding where my expectation of what the movie was, I wanted it to be, versus the movie it actually was, is.
Yeah, and I mean, with the show, quite often, I mean, I've brought this up before, people especially have brought films to me that I wasn't a huge fan of, and then once I revisited it for a second time, you are absolutely right, there are some films that I've seen that I revisited that I have to acknowledge I was probably in a bad mood when I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
Or just for whatever reason at that point in my life, I'm going to say this a lot, I was not able to vibe with the film as it was, that I've gone back later and really appreciated. I've had the opposite happen, but especially on this show, there are some films that I'm kind of like, eh, and then when I research, I really, really appreciate. Do I love the film Jacob Tutu Meets a Hooded Fang? No, but I got to read some Mordecai Richler, which I had never done before, about some interesting Canadian production companies that I didn't know about. And then once you knew the shoestring that it was made on, it became more quaint.
Yeah.
I'll use that as an example. So he grew up loving zombie films, always dreamed of making one as a kid, but he had to just accept that at that time when he was considering it, when he was starting to make films, that was not the type of film made in Quebec at the time. Much like in the rest of Canada, Quebec has its own sort of government funds. There have been some directors we have brought up in the past. And I just want to say, it's kind of cool to tackle another Quebec film and a Quebec filmmaker. We don't get to do it enough. But we brought up with other Quebec filmmakers that navigating the funding system can be very frustrating, especially when quite often they want to promote a certain, if not image of Quebec, then Quebec sensibilities or Quebec history.
Yeah.
So at the time, he was like, no, there's no way I'm going to be able to get provincial funding.
They have the same bias towards tourism advertisements that the federal government has.
Fair enough. And you know what? I think we're going to start talking about Quebec culture, obviously, a little bit more in this, because it's one of those films that I really wonder, and I might be getting ahead of myself here, there were a few lines in there that I was like, is that political? That maybe something, we'll get into this, maybe lost in translation or whatever. It's just one of those films that I wonder.
Yeah.
With the sort of ideas of when they're talking about, you know, oh, all the funding and resources are going to the cities and they're ignoring us in the rural areas. I know the idea of rural Quebec versus Montreal is a thing.
Yeah.
You know, and a very contentious thing in voting. Some politicians really try to, much like in the States, go for that sort of rural vote if they know that they can't win over, you know, like more right-wing people, with Montreal being a lot more left-leaning, right? So I thought about that with this film a couple of times. But we are getting ahead of ourselves. So yes, he dreamed of making this sort of a film, never thought it would happen. But a producer that he was working with, whenever they were spitballing ideas for future films, always said that he would get so excited when talking about like a zombie film idea. He said, just start writing it anyways. You know, just in case something happens, you'll have it in your back pocket. So he was working on this screenplay while he was working on other films. And then something happened called The Walking Dead. Referring to the TV show in this instance, was so popular and so huge, the producer kind of tapped him on the shoulder and was like, you know, I think they might be willing to fund a zombie film now. Because much like Canadian film funding, if it's not extolling Canadian values or something that they want to portray on screen, if it's going to be a moneymaker and put money back into the system, then quite often they'll bite.
Yeah, we got out of the business of genre films after the tax shelter and sort of it took the zombie wave to get back in.
Exactly. And yet, so they reached out, and yes, financiers were now willing to do a Quebec zombie film. So he basically said that he wrote this film in his barn. Apparently he lives on a farm in rural Quebec. That's where a lot of the movie was actually shot.
Okay.
Most of the zombies are friends and family. People that he knows. So they would bring in said makeup artist, and he was like, yeah, and then I would like fill my sister with a huge gash across her face running across the field. So I couldn't get anything too in-depth about the making of it, but it does really seem like it was a low-key sort of family affair. You know, like that scene at the end with the horses running, those were his horses.
Right.
That he literally just went out into a field behind his farm and shot that. Some scenes in a barn are literally the barn that he wrote the movie in.
Right.
So I think that is really cool. This is a really sort of literally friends and family effort. Obviously, all the actors are professional actors, but for any of the background people that they could use. He said that was really interesting because he really liked the idea of the zombie screaming. we should get this out of the way. The zombies are a little bit different than zombies in other films.
Yeah.
Number one, unless they're wounded, they don't look like they're decaying.
Well. Yeah. They're a little closer to the infected people in The Crazies, the Romero movie.
That's a good call. But one of their unique features is their scream. And I have to admit that I found that scream really unsettling. I don't know the circumstances of how you watch the film, but it wasn't late, but because it's getting darker early, it was pretty dark in here. I'd eaten my dinner, just my typical lamp on in the corner. The shrieks, I wasn't like hiding behind the couch, but the zombie shrieks, they do shriek when they get hit, which kind of implies that they feel pain, but they also do it when they like notice somebody.
It's something I appreciated too, because I really, one of the things about zombie movies is they can be what I like to call rude about breaking the tension. Like they tend to get a little too jumpy on you, whereas the scream is shocking without being really snapping you back in that way that a rude jump scare does.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add this here. This is from an interview with The Verge. I had the feeling that they scream because they want to get out of their bodies. Part of them knows that they were human. We tried lots of sounds to make the zombie scary, but we realized the real sound of the zombie was the sound of them, the actors. Every zombie who screams, it's the actor. There's a little added sound, maybe 30%, but when we tried more, it wasn't real. I can't tell you what other sounds, it's a secret, but it's mostly human. I told the actors, you are a zombie, you rage, but have also sadness, so put in your scream a mix of sadness and rage.
It's very akin to some of the weird noises people made in Pontypool, or the ones that are described making, yeah.
And I think this, I'll read this other passage now, and I think this might address some of the points that you were making of the film, is the fact that something like Pontypool or Blood Quantum has a high concept to it.
Mm-hmm.
All takes place in a radio station, they're surrounded by zombies, you had never seen anything like that before. Mm-hmm. Then you have Blood Quantum. It's on an indigenous reserve right out of the gate before Jeff Barnaby starts exploring some really crazy ideas. It's already something you hadn't seen before, right? Mm-hmm. A different sort of setup. Heck, even though it's Fido, it's after the zombie wars and now zombies are being used for domestic service.
Yeah.
And they have basically a zombie butler played by Billy Connolly. Again, you're like, oh, I haven't seen this before, right? A really hard spin. This is what Robin Aubert said about the making of the film. I didn't want to reinvent the horror genre or the zombie film. For me, what I like about zombie film is that it's a zombie film. It's not that I wanted to make it original. I just have a point of view about the humanity of those zombies. And I think that's the difference between my zombies and those of another guy.
I appreciate that. And I think that's something you can really see in how, you know, it really does wear its influences on its sleeve. It is playing two tropes in a way that I grated on me at first, but I think, you know, knowing they did it with intention and it wasn't something they just sort of fell into does make me feel a little more warm to it than I think I did watching it.
Well, and speaking of The Walking Dead, I mean, I really thought about the comic book a lot. Not in terms of the content, even though there is a stretch of the comic where they are just sitting around a farm, but Kirkman's, like Robert Kirkman's original pitch for the book, after they got past the whole, he lied to Image and said that it was really about aliens creating the zombies so they would actually fund the book with no intention of doing it. I don't know if you ever heard that story.
No, I didn't.
But that's how The Walking Dead got picked up by Image. He basically, at the pitch meeting, was like, and it'll turn out it's actually aliens that are making the zombies with zero intention. Because his actual intention was what happens after the zombie movie.
Right.
What happens when people, right after the outbreak, which is what most zombie films are, and then you have to live in this world. So I kind of thought about that a lot with this film.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, how are you getting by in this existence? So I think because I had read that interview before as well, like I did the bulk of my research before actually watching the film, I think I was kind of prepared for that.
Mm-hmm.
That I knew that he wasn't trying to break the wheel, that it was more going to be the visuals, because we will get this out of the way. Like he cited his two biggest influences on this were the filmmakers Robert Bresson, the French filmmaker, who did movies like L'Argent, All Jose Balthazar, otherwise known as the Sad Donkey movie. Mm-hmm. Probably the best King Arthur film, Lancelot du Lac, which I could see a lot of imagery in this in terms of like the smoke and the fog and the way that he shoots nature. And speaking of nature, the other filmmaker that he mentioned was Andrea Tarkovsky, who did films, the Russian filmmaker, who did films like Solaris. Andrei Rublev, a lot of the sort of images of the forest as well with this, but most importantly, Stalker.
Mm-hmm.
And have you ever seen any of Andrea Tarkovsky's? I'm probably saying that wrong. Tarkovsky? Yeah, I think it's Andrei Tarkovsky.
Don't think so.
They are all really long. They all take their time with what they are doing, but they are some of the most beautiful, amazing films ever made. And when you ever do research into how he made his films, sometimes in like radioactive areas, like with Stalker, a little bit of a Werner Herzog type as well. Right. When you read it up, it was just in communist Russia.
Right.
So a lot of these behind the scenes thing took a while to come up, but specifically Stalker is, this isn't a hot take or anything, is my favorite Tarkovsky film. And I often say that the ending of Inception rips off the ending of Stalker. Like when I first saw Inception, I was like, I was actually kind of pissed off because I knew that most of the people that were going on about how great Inception was hadn't seen Stalker, and just like how it basically rips off the ending. But that is a guide taking a stalker, like a guide taking a bunch of people through this sort of post-apocalyptic wasteland, hence an irradiated area where they were filming. And a lot of this stuff is like through woods, long thing. So I saw a lot of that imagery as well. So I was thinking about like the sort of filmic influences when I was watching, because this is a gorgeous film. This is a really good looking film. Yeah. It is shot really inventively. Like there are a lot of shots in this film where people's heads are intentionally cut off, like not literally cut off in the scene, but the cropping of the frame, weird angles of people walking into things. There were a lot of shots in this film that I was like, this is interesting. So I think that was the vibe that I got on.
Yeah.
That you didn't, because I knew that it was not going to try to break the wheel story-wise or setting-wise, but I knew that it was probably a little bit more of a technical experiment as well, especially if he's shooting it around his farm with his family around.
Yeah.
And these actors that he got.
Yeah. There's a quality to it also that where you feel like it's being very economical. Like the resources they have, they are deploying in all the right places to maximum effect, just in terms of like the visual effects, the makeup work, the you know, exploding, like literally exploding heads, not just the frame cutoffs. Yeah, you get the sense they spent all the money on all the right things.
Exactly. And the only special effects or anything close to it in this film is some of the makeup, obviously, and the smoke machine at the end. He's like, for most of the movie, it's the natural fog in the area, but the sort of heavy fog scene, which we'll get to later on, definitely. But he's like, we had to get a machine to artificially do that. He was like, I didn't want to do CGI because I saw that version of the fog that was made about 15 years ago and it used CGI and he hated the way that it looked. It's like, you can't fake fog, really. So anyways, he needed it for that. And he said that was frustrating because you can't direct fog.
Yeah.
So
the wind could pick up. You've just lost your shot.
But yeah, the only other thing about the aesthetic that he said that I found interesting was that he wanted the zombies to actually show pain to constantly remind the audience of the consequence of violence. He said that that basically removed the video game aesthetic that some survivalist movies can have sometimes, especially when there's any sort of action involved.
I mean, it's by nature, zombie movies are preoccupied with headshots the same way video games are.
Okay, well, out of curiosity, are you warming up to the film a little bit?
Yeah, I think I'm getting what they were going for a little more. And I think that was where a lot of my disconnect was, where I just sort of, like, I think I just kept seeing what felt like a similar scene of someone just having a long, meaningful stare down a hallway or down through a stand of trees.
Yeah.
And being like, all right, well, there's going to be a guy behind him in about 15 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, it's a, for the most part, it's a predictable film.
Yeah.
There are some elements that aren't, and we'll get into those. But again, in terms of the zombie elements, I used to have a rule with zombie films that it was like, there had to be at least like one really kind of fun zombie kill in it to make it justifiable, especially when there was a huge glut of zombie films in the early to mid 2000s, that I would walk away and be like, yeah, it was a pretty shitty zombie film, but that one scene was really great, right? Like Flight of the Living Dead. Like Flight is in an airplane.
Right.
There's a scene where a zombie bites a pilot, but it's an old woman.
Right.
So she didn't have any teeth. So at first you're like, oh no, the pilot. And then it's funny because the zombie was just basically gumming him. Right. And I was like, that's pretty fucking funny. I've never seen that in a zombie film before. So that justified spending an hour and a half on Flight of the Living Dead, which it would not surprise me if that film has disappeared off the face of the planet by this point. Okay, let's round this out. Really quickly go into the cast, most notably, and I'm kind of curious about your take on the characters, because I found them a little bit different than characters in most zombie films. They're a little bit more zen, and they're a little bit more slice of life like just normal people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. You don't have like the hardcore survivalist character or anything like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's, they're all kind of just, yeah, they're surprisingly normal for people living through a zombie apocalypse. I mean, that's kind of what they touch on quite a lot is that like,
I mean, they're obviously traumatized as fuck.
Yeah. But it's, they have, I mean, for as much as they sort of focus on them as being very rural people, like they're all still trying, like, in their normal lives, they were maintaining community across huge bounds of occasionally, of sometimes dangerous terrain,
yeah.
And that part has never changed. It's just now full of flesh-eating monsters instead of, like, bears.
Yeah. No, I totally get that. And it's also a weirdly meditative film.
Mm-hmm.
Like, not to go back to, like, Tarkovsky, and it's I'll get this out of the way. I was more positive on this film than you were. I actually am very glad that I watched it.
Mm.
It had been a long time since I'd seen a film that I actually thought about the craft a lot while I was watching it, that I was very technically intrigued
mm-hmm.
by a film, which I only ever really do with low-budget films. I'm not very rarely super impressed by big-budget stuff, right? I'm not going to say this is like one of my favorite movies on the planet mm. or one of my favorite zombie films either. Pound for pound, I would rather watch Blood Quantum. If I was going to watch a Canadian zombie film. But I'm just saying, like, there's a lot to get out of this, and I think I would recommend it. Like, almost every award that it was nominated for at the Canadian Screen Awards, I'm like, I'm not disagreeing.
Yeah.
You know? Good job. Okay, so the cast. The main character, played by Marc-André Grandin, who plays the main character of Bonin. Now, he's the only actor that you might have seen before.
Mm.
I shouldn't be presumptuous about that, but I'll be fair with you and the audience. Not a lot of Quebec film really gets out of the province of Quebec.
Yeah.
Only certain bigger titles. He has happened to star in two of them. Marc-André Grandin. He played the character of Zachary Belieu in the film Crazy, which was a big darling about 10 years ago. Basically about growing up as a queer kid in Montreal in the 70s, which is a really good film. And where you might have seen him, he played Xavier Leflemme in the film Goon.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So about hockey enforcers, which
I was wondering why he seemed familiar.
He looked very different at the time.
Yes.
With hair.
Yeah.
And a little bit less weight. I'm showing the picture from the Wikipedia page, and if you see that, you're like, oh, that's the guy from Goon.
Well, I think that picture is what, like a decade prior?
Probably, yeah. And then we have, and again, the rest of the cast, a lot of credits, a lot of mainly acting or directing in Quebec film and TV. But I just want to give them credit because I think the cast is uniformly really good
mm-hmm.
in this film. We have Monica Chokri as Tanya, Bridget Poupart as Celine, Luke Prohl as Riel, Charlotte St. Martin as Zoe, and Marie-Jeanette Gouet as Therese. And we're probably going to get to these characters a little bit later because I think to get into some of the ideas of the film, we're going to have to do a little bit of a walkthrough through the plot.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to shout out to them. I am a little bit ashamed to say the only of the films that I have noticed that I had seen are Crazy and Goon
mm-hmm.
that any of them had acted in. But maybe it'll be like some other Quebec films that it'll be nice that when I watch more Quebec film, I'll be like, oh, that's so-and-so from this Quebec movie
mm-hmm.
that I did for the show about 3 years ago. Nice to see them pop up again.
You'll start stitching together that mental map of who's who.
No, and like I said, one of the fun things about doing these sort of films is that you get exposed to people that you had no idea existed that are making great work. And yeah, okay. Let's talk about the film itself. I do really like the opening of this film where it's just the chair in the field with the fog and then yeah. you have a race car. Like it immediately like cuts
yeah.
to like a racing field.
Yeah, that opening is really good.
It was already like, oh, okay. Like I said, something you really hadn't seen before. You start off with the start of a different zombie film. And then it goes to this other zombie film. And who knows what's going on with this other zombie film.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of forget about that opening scene, right?
Yeah.
Because it's basically a racetrack. A race car driver is making out with a woman. Another woman is storming up to them. You're like, oh, she's mad because he's cheating on her or whatever. And it turns out she's infected. Which introduces you to the concept that these zombies aren't really... You can't visually just tell right off the bat
mm-hmm.
if they're zombies. There might be something a little bit off about them. So I mean, it kind of sets up the rules, but then when she's biting the other woman, not the race car driver, it immediately cuts away. Yeah, it immediately jumps to Bonin and his friend Vizina, who mm-hmm. are burning a pile of zombie bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, cool intro.
Yeah, yeah.
And we'll be getting back to it. Yeah. So, Bonin, who ostensibly becomes her main character, and his friend Vesnia, they're basically standing around making jokes. I'm not going to repeat them because most of them are really bad dad jokes, but the very first one is probably one of the funnier masturbation jokes I've heard in a long time. I don't know if you remember it, but it's the one where the guy goes to the doctor and he, you know, goes to get checked out, just a regular checkup. And the doctor tells him, you know, you really need to stop masturbating. And the patient goes, why? And he's like, because I'm trying to examine you.
Yeah, that one's a classic.
That one I actually chuckled
at. I've always loved that joke.
But that's kind of the shtick with Bonin, our main character, is that he kind of deflects with humor, these kind of dumb dad jokes. They don't go into depth with all these characters, but you find out, you get the inclination that most of these characters have had families, wife and kids before. Mm-hmm. They kind of infer through little things. And the other thing that I like about the general setup is that there's many times, I know this sounds weird, but there's many times where you get the inkling that the film could go in a certain direction. Mm. And then they kind of just veer off in a different direction. You know, this whole movie could have been just been the characters of Bonin and Vizina going around and their exploits. But very quickly, Vizina is killed off. Mm. Probably what you were saying, one of those sort of very predictable deaths.
Yeah.
You know, I was sitting there being like, don't go into the woods alone.
Yeah, right.
Not when you see a creepy girl standing at the end of a long dirt road in the trees. But I don't think that's what this movie is out for. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I think that's when he was saying that he wasn't trying to change the zombie film. He was still going to be leaning into the don't go in there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's even his first film, when I watched it, there's a lot of sort of questionable character logic, shall we say, that happens. Yeah, but immediately I was like, okay, it's really cool. Like when they go past the girls in the forest and he tells them to back up, and then you have the camera panning with the POV of the vehicle, and then it locks in this amazingly framed shot of the two girls standing in there. I was like, okay, like there's some really kind of fun visual inventiveness going on with the film.
Yeah, and those kind of old, like using those like backwoods or logging roads gives you a lot of great opportunities to frame a very dramatic looking shot the way they did there.
Well, and I get the impression, and I'll be very interested going into some of his other films, because like I said, with his first film, I definitely got this, of wearing influences on this sleeve. You know, I was very much reminded about, with the number of zombie children in this movie, of The Brood.
Mm.
David Cronenberg's The Brood, where you have all the little murder children quite often walking around in remote areas by themselves, and this natural strangeness of even just seeing the imagery of a child being where they're not supposed to be alone can be kind of off-putting and offsetting to your sensibilities. So, yep, Vizina, his friend and comedy partner, dies. One of the things that I do like about this film, and they do it with the scene between Bonin and Vizina, it's not an immediate, like oh, you got to shoot him in the head sort of idea.
Yeah.
They're kind of acclimated so much, I think almost to the point that they realize that it's going to happen inevitably.
Mm.
They're just kind of trying to hold it off for as long as possible. There are scenes like what happens here of them just lying in the back of the pickup truck, just kind of small talking, not even talking about dying, but just kind of small talking in the last moments of the person's life. And I did think about that a lot with a lot of these characters when the deaths inevitably happen. And again, none of them are surprises. There's no real twists in terms of who dies. So we're really not giving anything away or spoiling. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can even really spoil much of this movie. It's more you watch it for the visual richness of it that this film actually has, especially for such a low budget. To note, I couldn't find the budget of the film anywhere, but because it is a Quebec film and their industry, you don't have this sort of stuff published as much. Mm-hmm. But you can obviously tell it wasn't for a lot of money. But anyways, regardless, yes, with all the characters, that's part of the meditativeness of the film that I like. Of after everyone is bit, for the most part, there's a sort of mellow period afterwards, shall we say. Mm-hmm. A moment of introspection, which I thought was kind of interesting. What the characters say and what they end up talking about. So he immediately starts going off on his own. He finds this like survivor retreat, I guess it is.
It's a hunting camp.
It's a hunting camp, right. And he comes across another hunting camp member. And this is one of the funny ones, because this guy is done up in camo. He has like a balaclava, like the kind of over face mask done in camo. He seems like one of those sort of douchey survivalist guys that would have a gun rack on the back of his car.
Yeah, he looks like he's out there practicing for a guerrilla war that's never coming and he's not prepared for.
But he basically mentions that he has a woman tied up in one of the cabins that claims that they were bit by a dog, but he doesn't believe her, so basically has her tied up. So Bonin basically goes in to check out what's going on. He starts checking out for supplies, sees her tied up. She pleads with him, but he decides to leave her in there. Meanwhile, I find it funny, and this is kind of, I think it's meant more for comedy. The survivalist goes out and does a dumb thing and gets killed. And you're at first being like, how did he ever survive here? But I think that's kind of the joke, right?
Yeah, he never left the camp.
And then later on, you have the most incompetent guy.
Yeah.
We'll get to this character. Yeah. But managing to survive and being happy-go-lucky, and the guy's the biggest fucking idiot on the face of the planet until his stupidity catches up with him towards the end of the film.
There is a fun moment I noticed where, or something I thought about when she was tied up in the bunk, where she starts going off on this swearing tirade. And it's one of those moments where you realize how much is getting lost in translation with the Netflix subtitles, where the subtitle is Jesus fucking Christ. And the string of swears she gives is much longer, much more colorful, with a couple of tabernacles in there.
I did pick up on the couple of tabernacles. But the zombies basically kill the survivalist guy. They start encroaching, and that's when he decides to free the character of Tanya. And then once they are on the land, they stumble across a young child that they take under their wing, becomes sort of like a Ripley-Newt relationship from Aliens. And then the other main character we're introduced at this point, and probably one of my favorite performances, is Brigitte Poupart as Celine, that we're introduced to by her driving through small-town Quebec and then playing really loud Quebecois pop on the radio to lure out zombies and kill them with a machete.
It's funny thinking about sort of this getting financed in the back of The Walking Dead, where they really put a Michonne type in the movie, you know? She's the person in a business suit, or formerly a business person walking around, who's like preternaturally good with a blade.
I guess she just kind of cleaves them.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like there's a lot of finesse, you know, just whap them on the back of the head, but I could see that.
Yeah, the sword is magic, is what I'm saying.
I guess so, yeah, I could see that. That didn't really cross my brain, because I guess I just kind of thought that it's like, what's the best thing that I could use to bludgeon something almost immediately? But I really like her performance. She's the one that you could tell, I think she even mentions that she had a couple of kids at one point and a husband. And she kind of symbolizes to me, which doesn't really get explored in a lot of zombie survival films, of the ones that would surprise you that are actually really good at this. That unlike the survivalist that for all of his outfits is doing really dumb things in the woods that get him caught and eaten, whereas this woman seems to, against what you would assume all expectations, actually really good at what she does going around. And you're right. Like, if she was cleaned up, like all the blood and dirt removed and stuff like that, she would just seem like a typical Montreal going businesswoman.
Yeah.
Middle-aged businesswoman. She stumbles across a remote cabin, which has, I think it's fair to say, elderly pair of women, Zoe and Therese. This is when she goes to their farmhouse to steal some gasoline. They catch her, basically make her strip down to her underwear to prove that she hasn't been bitten, at which point they welcome her into her home. We're not going to do a huge beat by beat, but this is kind of the basic setup of what we have. Bonin and his new group end up coming to the farmhouse because Bonin knows the two older women. They find out that the zombies are basically in waves. By tracking them, you can tell that they are coming their way. That this farmhouse of theirs is no longer going to be safe. So what is their plan going to be? And then also there is the odd pairing of, like, there's a separate plot line going on for a long time, which is a elderly businessman named Riel and a young child named T. Cole. A young kid with a rifle, they kind of stumble across each other in the woods, and they're making their way. These are ostensibly what is going to be our zombie survivor group when they eventually all meet up. Again, I just kind of wanted to bring up the basics of it. Now, we brought up the road trip quality to this. I really liked seeing the shots of rural Quebec. I brought this up to you before about the possibility of a future road trip. A couple of times when driving out here where I live in Nova Scotia to the family cottage, which is in Northern Ontario, drive from here to Montreal, and then you have the option of taking the 400 highways down basically around Toronto and then heading up. Or you can do what I've done a couple of times, which is driving through kind of more rural Quebec over into Northern Ontario. kind of going there, not quite on back roads, but you're not driving on the 400 highways, put it that way. And yeah, my brain really got taken back to those couple of trips because it looks a lot like what you see in the film. I know you could just objectively just kind of go, well, it's just random countryside.
Right.
But it did, looking at it, I was like, that really does look like the roads I would have been driving on to get to the cottage there.
Yeah, I mean, it's the real character of it comes out, especially in the character of it comes out in those big wide shots where you really see the topography kind of roll and crest.
Now, the one aspect that is new to this, we brought up the screaming zombies, which I do kind of like as an aesthetic. I don't know if it's something that I would want to see in every zombie film, but for the aesthetic workings of this film, I really liked. And we know a little bit of the director's intent as to why that is. What is your opinion? Have you ever seen Close Encounters of the Third Kind?
I actually haven't.
Oh, okay. There's a really famous scene in that movie. And it's actually, it was one of my dad's favorite films.
Right.
I remember I'd seen it a couple of times as a young child because my dad had like his four or five favorite films that he liked. And Close Encounters of the Third Kind was one of them. There's a scene where Richard Dreyfuss gets obsessed with a certain shape.
Oh, yeah. I mostly know it through the reference in UHF.
Yes. Of him molding the mashed potatoes, being like, this means something. The zombies are kind of doing the same thing. They are making huge piles of junk.
Yeah.
Like a couple of stories tall. Piles of junk. And the character of Bonin kind of stumbles across him in the woods, and you could tell that he's never seen them doing something like this before. The zombies are doing something odd. What are your opinions of that? Because you see the zombies kind of walking around with items as they pile up these sort of edifices, for lack of a better term, of human refuse.
You know what? It's I wasn't sure exactly, like, it was a neat visual, but I wasn't sure what they were going for with it until I think you put it in context of them trying to sort of, and I guess they do mention this in the film, of them, like, sort of the zombies don't know what else to do with themselves. They still vaguely, on some level, register who they were, and so they just go home. And so, like, you know, part of human life is just accumulating crap. And so some impulse just says, I don't know, put objects in a pile.
That makes total sense. Now, also, I kind of think there's something a little bit more... My take was that there's something a little bit more supernatural going on with it. There's zero proof or nothing in the text to prove that. It's just, you know, like I said, the odd behavior. It kind of reminded me a little bit of... Well, as we brought up before when we talked about other zombie films, but of the original Dawn of the Dead. With the whole thing of like, well, why are they coming to the mall? And it's like, well, instinct, I guess. It's like one of the best lines of any zombie film. But also Romero's Day of the Dead, where the zombies start, after a period of time, a little bit of sentience. So a zombie who was a soldier would eventually be like, oh, I can pick up this gun and point it at somebody. Or they start remembering sort of motor skills. So they would walk up to a door and then just be like, look at the door for a while, and then reach out and just like use the doorknob. I think there's a little bit of that here. And that's one aspect that doesn't get explored a lot. It does a little bit in Fido. But the idea with most zombie films taking place like right after the outbreak, what happens a year or 5 years in or 10 years in, what would your reaction be if all of a sudden you realize, oh, wait, there's still humanity in there and we've been shooting them in the head. And meanwhile, when I thought, oh, my brother is dead, even though he's walking around, this is a shell, so we killed it. What if I learned that there was still a part of him in there? And then if he had survived for 5 years... his old self would start coming out again.
Right.
Not something that comes up a lot in zombie films, but it's an aspect that really fascinates me. And that's where it seemed like before Romero's career went off the rails and he had to stop making zombie films for a while, it looked like that was kind of the direction he was going in. So there's a little part of me that's like I said, like the Close Encounters is a part of these like zombies, a part of humanity in them that is like, again, going back to Close Encounters, this means something. Like to them making these edifices here and there has some sort of importance to them, whether they're conscious of it or not. It's like the subconscious of the zombies and a collective subconscious deciding to do this weird thing. I know I'm kind of all over the place, but I'm trying to get, like, there was something that I liked about it, about the concept of the zombie and this happening that I really dug.
It's one of those things that makes you wonder what kind of movie would have the chops to, you know, if zombies are, you know, turning the other into a faceless, hungry horde. You know, how do you elegantly do the metaphor of rehumanizing the horde?
Now, really from this point, before we talk about the end, there's just a few random things that I want to bring up. Yeah, the dude that I brought up, who seems like an absolute idiot. What is he, like a cop or something like that?
No, he's an army private.
He's an army private. He literally randomly pops up here and there. They'll be quiet in the car, and he decides to run up to the window and be like, boo!
Yeah.
Out of nowhere. The dumbest thing you could do in a zombie environment, right? Like, you immediately think that. What's the name of that character in Groundhog Day? Played by Stephen Tobolowsky.
Right.
His character. Sorry, I couldn't remember his name. I was kind of reminded of that, this annoying character that pops up once in a while in the movie, and the main characters are just kind of like, okay, how do I get away from this guy? But again, I think part of the joke is the opposite of the survivalist guy. How has this guy managed to survive this long when he is literally startling people in a dangerous environment with guns?
Right.
I don't know. You have any takes on him?
I just
the payoff does make it worthwhile.
Yeah, I just realized it's got a, speaking of Bill Murray, it's got very much a parallel to him and how he ends up in Zombieland.
Yeah. I've been tempted to go back to Zombieland.
I don't know. I remember reading reviews of the sequel and being like, I don't need to watch that first one again.
But I look at it now and it's just kind of like, I like the cast. Hey. Like, I like Emma Stone even more now than I did when Zombieland first came out. I don't know. I kind of dug it at the time, and then I just never went back to it all, and I just wondered if it would age well. Regardless, I guess we're talking about zombie films, but... yeah, but anyways, spoilers, he does it one time too many before the climax at the end when everybody is stressed out. He comes around the corner, jumps out from behind a tree and goes boo, and this time one of the characters does actually shoot him.
Yeah, you don't gotta wait long for Chekhov's gun to go off on that one.
Chekhov's idiot. And then the way that it shot, at least the way that I read it, it's up in the air whether she knew it was him or not. Like, she might have just finally snapped and just been like, fuck this dude, and just shot him. Again, I think that's a pretty good fucking payoff for that character. That at first I was like, I don't know, why is this character here? It's kind of breaking the mood a little bit. And again, it might be that Quebecois sense of humor. The guy does come from a sketch comedy troupe.
Mm-hmm.
So to pay it off the third time that he does it, because it is that intentional. Never have a gay go more than three times, right? Mm. Or else then it's going to start getting tiresome.
Mm.
Third time, bam. He did it one too many times, and they just shoot him.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that bears reminding as well. This guy comes from a sketch comedy background.
Yeah.
So the sort of more segmented aspect of this film might come from that sort of sensibility. Because the other one that I watched of his, his first one, Saint Martyrs of the Damned, is very sort of segment as well. Mm. With like kind of, don't want to say a little... with sort of little sort of segments. Like, they're not like comedy bits, but, you know, they are more like chapters serialized. So the ending, I think, is really impressive. Mm-hmm. Just generally, what are your thoughts of the ending? Because you could tell that this is where most of the energy was going to be going towards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was a good finale. A lot of really good sort of setting of stakes that was... I think what I felt at the time was almost missing up to that point of just like in a moment, you know, you watch two, like the meaningful glance between two characters suddenly did a ton of work very quickly. Just like when, Therese kind of looks at everyone, looks back at the horde and is just like they kind of nod to each other and she just sort of stands and waits.
Yeah.
And then, her with the machete just sort of like, again, like kind of looks at her, looks at them and just sort of pulls down, you know, pulls that out and just starts hacking away.
Okay, yeah, because you're talking about one of my favorite shots of the entire film.
Yeah.
So we'll get to that. So basically, the setup, they realize they're fucked.
Yeah.
That's the ending. They're like, we are fucked. And the general consensus is, let's have the kids survive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if any of us survive, that's great. But we're basically going to focus our energy on getting the kid out of here. Which means that some of them are intentionally going to die. Like, out of the two old women, one of them randomly gets bitten an incident between them. So, and it's not implied that they're in a relationship or anything like that, but it is implied that they are very long old friends at the very least. That was one of my favorite conversations that I was referring to before one of them dies. One of the two older women are bit and the other one decides that is when she's going to ask, no, honestly, what do you think of my pickle recipe? Because they're eating pickles throughout the entire film that she has made herself. So it's like, okay, now you are dying. You have no reason to lie. Seriously, do I put too much dill in the pickles? And then the other woman is like, no, they're actually really good. And then they just sit there quietly as he kind of passes away. I like that.
Yeah.
I thought that was fun. Don't need to have this deep, like, oh, I love you forlorn sort of thing. It's just like, it's always bugged me. I always thought you lied to me about my pickle recipe and I just need to know.
Yeah.
You never know. This movie did get me thinking that it's like, you never know. Like I said with the character of Celine, who would actually be good in a crisis situation? You know, the guy who talks up owning guns and might be absolutely useless. And meanwhile, the middle-aged mother might actually be really kick-ass, right? You never know what those final discussions are going to be. You know, it might be like really forlorn and upset, or it might just be like a little bit of like a, hey man, it was good having you around.
Yeah.
We all knew this was going to happen eventually.
Yeah.
Because you also get this sort of sense of resignation, is a sense that, again, like I was saying, they know they're going to go down eventually.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of when.
Yeah, yeah. Everyone's got on a ticking clock at that point, and they've seen, you know, like you're that deep into a zombie apocalypse, you've seen or made a few of your neighbors die a couple of times, where you're just like, okay, at this point we don't weep, we just quietly say goodbye
and move on. The only like sort of sign that there is of still, like, obviously they don't want to have other people die, but there is that one scene of Bonin with his friend who dies at the beginning that he has to get the other guy to finish him off.
Mm-hmm.
To make sure he isn't going to come back. So their humanity isn't completely stripped away. But again, there seems to be a sort of resignation going on here. So this sequence, I almost today went back and rewatched just the end sequence. I didn't, because I didn't want my brain to be mainly focused on that. But at some point, I'm going to go back and rewatch it. Because especially when you know how it was made, it was basically made around the dude's farm with family and friends. This sequence is impressive on so many levels. Number one, because of the scope of it, there are so many zombies in this. When you realize that all of the zombies in this are people that he knows with makeup on. There's no CGI, nobody digitally inserted. That one scene when they all pop up in the woods.
Yeah.
And they really all stand up. It's a bunch of people with makeup crouched down in the grass and they jump up all at once.
Yeah.
You could literally be like, okay, everybody, up while they're filming. And they all just pop up. It's so effective.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, that's really cool that the zombies were literally just like lying in wait.
Mm.
And then instinctively all at once, like they're all instinctively building these edifices. They just all immediately at once like zone in. Again, there are so many really cool shots. If you're into cinematography and if you're into sort of inventive camera work, definitely give this movie a shot. Because there's some fun stuff going on in here. Yep, you have the, which we know, it's not a surprise, but the artificial fog that's going around for this final showdown. There's that really cool sequence where you hear the baby crying, and then Celine goes to investigate, and then you see the zombie woman sitting there with a doll over and over again, pulling the string. There's a lot of good ideas, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of good stuff in here. And then, when they all start coming, most of the people start running off with the child, and Celine decides to stay behind. I said this is one of my favorite shots of the film because there's kind of a lot of balls to it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of balls to this shot because it could really not work, and it might not work for some people, but it really worked for me. Because she's standing there, fog around her, and it looks like she's blindly swinging. You do not see any zombies at all.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see her making connection with any zombies. She is literally standing in fog, waving the machete around as blood splatters on her. You could picture them filming this film with two people on either side with buckets of fake blood and a paintbrush, and they start shooting and she starts swinging at air, and there are people literally going dunk, dunk, blop.
Yeah.
And whipping blood at her. There is an artifice to that shot that you look at it and you're like, this is fake. She is obviously swinging at the air. There are obviously people throwing fake blood at her off of the screen. But there's that sort of sense of the artifice and the way that she's acting it that really worked for me.
I think also just looking at it, I'm like, I feel like they must have had like tubes and like fake blood under pressure to like kind of look a little bit like an arterial spray. Like it didn't look like it was just slopped out. Like some of that sort of goop flying in from the margins looking good sells it quite a bit.
And the shot doesn't go on for that long.
No.
But you can obviously, like I said, tell she's swinging at air.
I think there's only one real motion where it looked awkward, though, and she did, like, a thrust with it, and then it was just like, well, that looks weird and awkward. But every, like, big slash looked good. It didn't matter if there was something in front of her.
It was just something that I saw that I'm like, it is obviously a directorial decision.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was a decision made for budget or anything like that. It's like, no, we are going to do the shot. We are going to do it this way.
Yeah.
And it has a very unique look to it. And I just think it's really cool and works.
Yeah.
It just stood out for me. I'm like, that is a choice and that is an interesting one. I've never seen, at least in a horror film, somebody make a decision like that.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of reminded me of some of like the artifice of like later Akira Kurosawa films. again, he probably watched some of these films somewhere and was like, oh, I can pull that. Yeah. You know, he doesn't seem like a director that shies away from his influences, put it that way.
It looked at least as good as fighting CGI goons. We just pulled the camera tighter so you don't see CGI goons.
Fair enough. But I mean, there is a lot of shots of people fighting zombies, connecting.
Yeah.
You know, throats being ripped out, parts of heads being cut off. It deserved its win for best makeup. Again, it's the Canadian Screen Awards. Who knows what it's up against? It's not like it was up against Avatar. But an award's an award, and it definitely deserved it. So yes, as they are escaping, the child Zoe Bonin takes off with her, basically does what Celine did earlier once they get out of the woods. I'm going to slow down the zombies. You get Zoe to basically where we were going to try to hide. So you don't quite see what happens to Bonin to get infected, but we find out later that it happens. Again, spoilers. I mean, almost no one makes it out of alive, though, this film. Yeah. And again, I don't think that's the point of the film, right? Yeah. Like, who lives and who dies. There's a really cool shot. You could tell it's just a stripped out mine where Zoe goes down to the basement with Tanya. Tanya basically says, okay, I'm going to go out there and try to delay them too. You really don't know what the sort of end goal is here, but the idea is that it's like, okay, if you think it's safe, don't come looking for us. This is being said to the kid. Go out and find Route 113and see if you can find somebody to go with, like somebody who's alive that survived. So I don't think you see, like with Bonin, you don't see what happened in terms of them getting infected. I do like this bit. It was Chekhov's accordion. She's carrying it around in accordion for the entire film. And even Bonin at one point is like, why are you carrying this around?
Yeah.
Like, and they never say why she does. And then it's at the very end, which she's starting to distract the zombies away from Zoe, that she starts playing this accordion and all the zombies. That was a good bit.
It was good. Yeah. It was a good payoff to her carrying out the whole movie.
Yes. And so there's a really cool sort of drone shot above the mine when Zoe leaves. It's one of the few times that the camera kind of frees itself from the ground. Like, Zoe goes out of the mine, she starts walking off, and it just kind of picks up above the landscape and following her as she gets smaller as she walks towards the highway. Just thought it was a cool shot after all the violence, and it's very much a closely shot film, very much on the ground. You don't have tons of establishing shots. Like, you do have shots of the landscape in certain bits, but it's very much a neat technique that it kind of goes up at the end, that the camera is freed. It's not to get too film nerdy, right? Mm-hmm. But it literally starts floating into the air and it's sunny out.
Mm-hmm.
And you see her walking out of this mine. I just think a really kind of cool effect. And then the race car driver comes back.
Who I cannot get over how much he looks like Brett McPherson from Flight of the Conchords.
You are absolutely right. I didn't even think of that. I tried finding out the actor who played him because he did look familiar to me. And that might be why. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't listed in anything. I could have gone back to the credits, I suppose. But in terms of like the Wikipedia and stuff like that, there wasn't anything. But yeah, she's at the side of the road. She's just literally just sitting there with her belongings, waiting to see who shows up. And this really weird souped up race car comes driving up and out comes our driver from the very beginning of the film. Like I said, I have no idea what adventures he's had over the last, I want to say at least a few weeks, if not months, but apparently he's been surviving driving around in this souped up race car, which I don't know how that would work with the amount of noise that it makes.
Well, he leaves a note for them. The shack at which one of the older ladies, when that incident happens, they find a note from number 76, and that was him.
I did not put that together.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I just thought the note was from some random.
Yeah, that's why he signed it number 76, because he was number 76 in the race on his car and his jacket.
See, I'd completely forgotten about the race car driver by that point. So I was like, rando note.
Yeah.
Don't go into the city. Okay. But you get the idea that Zoe is going to be taken under the race car driver's wing and they will have further adventures surviving in rural Quebec because everything says don't go towards the cities. There was a one point that I made earlier on in the conversation that I found funny about them saying that all the resources were going towards the cities. Again, that is a very typical argument in Quebec. And you know what? I'm going to bring up my only real niggle with the film.
Mm-hmm.
It is the runtime.
Yeah.
This film, again, it's not a huge runtime. It's an hour and 45 minutes.
Could have cut down a little.
With credits. But especially with zombie films and horror films, I have the saying, any movie over an hour and a half has to earn every single minute to justify being longer. This is a me thing. Even though I like the atmosphere of this film, It did feel like it was lagging in a couple of places. I think those 13 minutes, 12 minutes before the credits, that could have been space to kind of tighten things up a bit. Mm-hmm. It is a niggle because overall, I personally am very positive on the film. I'm very glad that I watched it. Even talking about it today, some of the shots and everything like that, like, I'm even more positive after our conversation than when I went into it,
mm-hmm.
to be honest.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of my lingering impression has been improved by just going over this one, especially where you got more out of it.
Yeah, I mean, am I going to be rushing back to it? Not right away. Like I said, I think at some point, while I still have access to the file, I think I'm going to go back and rewatch the sort of end climax, like the sort of field confrontation. I think I'm going to go back and rewatch that, because especially after talking about it now and me remembering more about it, I'm like, okay, I got to put my director's hat on and actually look a little bit more intently as to each and every shot and what they're doing. But I think it ended up being a good Halloween episode.
Yeah, I think it was a solid pick. It kind of did what it said on the tin. It was a good, dependable zombie movie.
You know, and we both were a little bit adventurous with it. Neither of us had seen it before, but
yeah. It would be at least worth catching on Netflix before they delete it for a tax write-off.
Which we have to note, you can't see on Canadian Netflix.
No kidding.
The Netflix, it was only on US and European Netflix. Gotta love Canadian cinema. This has happened to other Canadian films like Siege that we talked about. Yep, it got international distribution, but not Canadian distribution rights for streaming.
That blows my mind.
So, which is why you can only rent it. I don't know. This was actually mentioned in one of the articles that I read. It specified that it is now available on American Netflix. So I guess it played Toronto because it won Best Canadian Feature Film at the Toronto International Film Festival. And whoever picked it up had distribution rights for American Netflix.
No wonder Quebec films don't break into Anglo-Canada. They don't get released here.
Well, a lot of Canadian films don't. Like I said, when we did our Siege episode, right?
Right.
That movie got European distribution. It got distribution in the States. But it never was shown in a theater in Canada until they started to do retrospective
wild
screenings. And it's just how distribution works, right? Like, if you don't have the sort of infrastructure to make sure Canadian films can be distributed and seen within Canada, you're going to want to make your money back through any distribution rights that you can. And sometimes, like with this, it's going to be not in Canada.
Mm.
Crazy, eh?
God.
All right. Well, we got to catch up. Weird thing to say, but happy Halloween to everybody at home. We've never actually done specifically a Halloween episode, just the way that the timing works out. And we are going to catch up and grab a beer around the corner, I think. Okay, North of Normal is a production of Eldritch Creative that can be found on Facebook at Eldritch Creative and Instagram at Eldritch.creative. North of Normal can be found on Facebook at North of Normal Pod and Instagram at North of Normal Pod. Intro music and outro music is by Dad vs. Son out of Hamilton, Ontario. That's it for now. Be safe.